The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Good evening. Welcome, welcome. There can be this way when we're meditating or just in daily life. We might have this idea, whether it's explicit or implicit, like, dang it, if only this thing wasn't here, then everything would be fine. If only the dog's neighbor's dog wasn't barking, or the dog's neighbor was whatever. If only this discomfort in the knee. If only I had a better boss. If only my relationships were perfect, or something like this. Of course we have these ideas. Like, if only this little difficulty or big giant difficulty weren't there, then everything would be fine. But there's this way that if we're able to meet whatever this perceived difficulty is, to meet it with presence, with awareness, with attention, instead of the way we often have this subtle hostility, like, dang it, if only this thing weren't here, go away. This, we might not even notice we have this subtle aversion or hostility towards it, but if we can put that down and just meet it with presence, as best we can, then what's in the way becomes the way. The obstacle, perceived obstacle, becomes the path. It is the path, in fact, actually. And it can be a trap to think that we just have to get rid of this something in order for our practice to unfold the way we would like, our meditation practice, our life to unfold. Instead, actually, it is the path, it is the practice to meet difficulties that we meet along the way. Hindrances don't block the path, they are the path. If we want to develop mindfulness or concentration or metta or whatever your mindfulness or whatever your meditation practice is, then of course, in order to develop or cultivate or strengthen or learn about, explore a meditation practice, you have to learn about everything that gets in the way, quote unquote, gets in the way. And learning about what gets in the way is how you find the way. It is the way. I'm hoping to unpack this a little bit, but one thing that might be helpful, or as I appreciate Joseph Goldstein, one of the elders, esteemed elders of this tradition, one of the people who brought it from Asia to the West, he describes as practice is to make the mind our friend. And so he's also pointing to this shift in relationship, where I kind of think we have to beat the mind into submission sometimes, or we have to get rid of certain things that the mind likes to do. But he's talking about, no, it's about making the mind our friend. So shifting our relationship to our experience. So we could say practice is about seeing again and again that those very states, those very experiences we feel like we don't really want to have, in fact, is the exact way forward. Is maybe the on-ramps to more freedom. On-ramps to more peace and ease. So one way this works, and I'll talk about the hindrances. Some of you will be familiar with this word hindrance. Traditionally, it points to this group of five. We could say energies or mind states or experiences that the Buddha talked about. And I appreciate that this is something the Buddha talked about thousands of years ago. So countless numbers of individuals have had this since then. These experiences that hinder, quote unquote, our mindfulness or our concentration or our being present. I'm not sure that hinder is the right translation of this word, but it's the one that we've inherited. So some of you will be familiar with this list of five. The traditional order is first is like the sensual desire, this sense of like, oh, I want more. This kind of like leading in. I want more of pleasant experiences. Desire alone is not the problem. It's this thinking that just pleasant sense experiences will make us happy. They're not lasting sources of happiness. They're not sources of lasting happiness. So leaning in, sense desire, leaning away. Nope, I don't want that. That's aversion or ill will. That's the second hindrance. This thing of like, get this away from me. I don't want it. That's the second one. The third one is often translated as sloth and torpor, which is just kind of this like really low energy and sometimes falling asleep, you know, that experience of it's not uncommon for in my role as a Dharma teacher to be seeing this happening, right? We all have this, right? Sometimes it's just the end of the day or whatever it is, right? We just, it's quiet, we close our eyes, you know, often just drowsiness or sleep arises. So low energy is the third. High energy is this fourth, this restlessness, this fidgety, like, get me out of here, this feeling like you just want to run out of here. For me, I often am experiencing that, like, in my arms and legs, like, I just got to go somewhere. So that's the fourth one is restlessness. And the last one is doubt. And it's often experienced as this vacillation or hesitation or like, or confusion, like, yeah, I'm not sure. Should I be doing this? Or maybe I should be doing that. Or, well, maybe this practice is better. Or I heard this teaching too. And then we just get stuck and just go round and round in circles, not really going anywhere, but kind of in a eddy of some sorts. So these five hindrances, sometimes we could talk about these of, as weather patterns that visit, you know, arise and pass away. But one way in which we can turn them into what we perceive that's in the way, is the way, is to notice how when these weather patterns arise, when they arrive, they color our perception. It's not just that we have a little bit of desire. It's the way that it really impacts our experiences and how we interpret experiences and in ways that we often are not noticing. And this is an example that I've given many times, but it had a big impact on me when I saw that. And I think it clearly demonstrates this. So as I was sitting in a retreat, and this was the during the meditation, I was noticing there was a lot of desire coming up. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I can imagine on some of these retreats, I'd be like designing more comfortable Zafu's cushions, right? You know, in my mind, they really should have a cushion like this or that, right? You know, because of the body starts to hurt right after meditating for so long, or I don't know what I was, but I remember a lot of desire showing up and then, having in this, in my mind, like, oh, this is desire, and be able to just let it soften. And then, you know, it would come up again. And sometimes it shows up as a little going forward or like the chin going up. Sometimes it's a little like this, you know, this. So the felt in the body, maybe it's not even so clear in the mind. So then I notice, oh, here's desire. And it kind of like abated, and then this happened again, and then it abated. And then finally, there was a settling down and some really pleasant, just calmness, just sitting. And then the bell rang. Like, okay. I was okay. That was an okay sit. And the next was lunch. This was before lunch. So I went to lunch. It's, for those of you who haven't been on retreat, it's a buffet, right? And we stand in line and we have our plates. And I get up to the table, the buffet table. I'm like, oh, this looks good. I'm going to put some of this. Maybe I'll have a little bit more. Oh, wow. I need this. Absolutely. Put this on. And then the next thing. Oh, wow. This looks really great. Put this on. And I had this huge amount of food on my plate, way more than anybody could eat. And I just hadn't noticed this desire was just showing up as the next thing was food. And I was just had all this desire. So there's this way when we have this hindrance, it colors so many things in ways that we don't even recognize. It's like if we have desire, then it almost wants to find things to land on to want. It's fascinating. Same thing with aversion. Like if there's a lot of discomfort in the knee or whatever it might be, somebody next to us is breathing too loudly, whatever it might be, then there's a way in which, oh yeah, and that's kind of irritating. They shouldn't wear those socks with that outfit. What are they thinking? And, you know, there's this way, like the temperature is too hot, it's too cold. And, you know, there's this, all this aversion just shows up. There's this general mind state that gets applied to all these different experiences. Usually we're thinking it's the other way. Those socks are wrong, therefore I'm feeling aversion. The temperature is wrong, therefore I'm feeling aversion. It's actually going the other way, but we don't notice that. And part of practice is to help notice this, is to help that when these hindrances arise, they color our perceptions. So there's this one way in which that notion that these obstacles become the path is that when we believe this coloring of the perceptions, if you will, desire and aversion are the obvious ones, or doubt is one too, that we can just not feel like we can't quite come to it. A decision or find the way forward or land on an answer. We just kind of feel like, well, I don't know, this kind of a feeling. We find that showing up in so many areas of our life. But when we recognize, oh, yeah, this is desire, and then maybe we're on the alert for the way it colors our perception, that there's a way that it's going to influence us, and things are going to be met with this flavor of wanting, or it's going to be met with the flavor of not wanting if ill will is there. Or if there's a lot of restlessness, maybe there's a way in which things will just feel agitating, just kind of like feeding this. But it's so helpful if we can recognize, oh, restlessness is here. And then maybe just remember that it colors our perception. It influences our experiences. So that's one way that it's the way forward, is that it can, that what's in the way turns out to be the way, is because if we can recognize, oh yeah, this colors my perception whenever this is here. And then there's a way in which this can open up different perceptions to arise, a different way of interpreting our experience, a different way of recognizing what's happening. And it turns out it doesn't matter so much what this other way is. It's more about just recognizing, oh, maybe it's more a question. Oh, I wonder if actually this, my perception is being influenced by desire. I wonder if my experiences are agitating. Maybe it's just because I have a sense of restlessness. To be sure, some things are agitating too, But to recognize the hindrance is present, to remember that it colors our perception, all our perceptions, and then to introduce a little bit of space, a little bit of questioning. Maybe what I'm perceiving isn't entirely accurate. Maybe there's another way that I could be interpreting this. Maybe there's another way that I could be perceiving this. And that leads to more freedom. This idea, there's another way this could be perceived. Even if you don't know what that other way is, just that little space, that little question of, is there another way? This is a door to freedom. So there's this way that not only is it question this lens, I'm sorry, question the current perception we're having in so many different things, it's also a way that it can support this sense of freedom, is we can notice that this, the way that it colors our perception often is impacting our view of ourself. Instead of, this is restlessness, it's, I'm restless. And then all this story making that goes on after this happening, like I'm a restless person. And then the suffering doubles, triples, quadruples, gets bigger and bigger. It starts to turn into, instead of an uncomfortable experience, then a whole big story about ourselves gets created. I'm always restless. I'm never going to calm down. And look at those people over there. They're sitting quietly. They're probably already in the 28th jhana or, you know, something like this. In the 47th level of awakening, clearly. I'm not, though, or something like this. So there's this way that this, not only how we perceive what's out there, but how we're perceiving ourselves gets impacted by these hindrances. So we could say that the Dharma invites a kinder, more spacious frame, that these are human energies. This is what it means to be a human, and it's passing through a human system instead of feeling like there means something about us as individuals. As I said earlier, I just love this, that the Buddha talked about this thousands of years ago. Just really highlights how many people, like it's countless people have had these experiences. It's just a human experience. Sloth and torpor is here, is different than, gosh, I am so drowsy, I'm always drowsy. It's a very different way to just hold our experience. So, I mean, the Buddha's simple instructions we can find in the Satipatthana Sutta is just to recognize that a hindrance is happening. Sense, desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. One of these five. So there's some, maybe two general skills we could say then about the hindrances that maybe can have this hinge away from which what's in the way becomes the way. Maybe I'm milking this a little bit too much, right? In the way is the way. I just kind of think it's cute. I kind of like it. So one, just recognize as best you can when a hindrance is present. Name it if you can. This is a way that maybe makes a little bit more space. And then can you change the relationship to it? Change the relationship is to no longer maybe be seen through the lens. The perception, maybe you can just recognize, oh yeah, it's here. And there's often a way when we first recognize a hindrance, there's this subtle way in which we say, dang it, I wish this weren't here. And that actually is aversion. And so when we recognize that there's this aversion, to whatever the hindrance is. Often there's aversion to aversion, but there can be aversion to sloth and torpor, aversion to ill will. Can we recognize the aversion? And that maybe is the new hindrance. And just recognize, oh yeah, I'm probably seeing many things with aversion now. So to shift our relationship is to notice most likely there is aversion there. And can we be okay with that aversion? That's just the next hindrance that's shown up. So maybe I'll just say a little bit about these hindrances. So we could say that desire, it colors our perception. And can we recognize that or remember this? And then let this recognition maybe let us learn something about the experience. For example, maybe you're at home meditating, or maybe you're here meditating, and maybe in the just after a few minutes sitting, the mind says, oh, maybe I should check the phone. Maybe I got that email back from so-and-so, or maybe I'll get an update on something or other. And there's this way that practicing with sensual desire just highlights that our imagined sources of nourishment, what we think it's going to be helpful and supportive to check our phone and see if maybe something new or maybe some connection with somebody. We think that this is going to be sources of lasting happiness. Even that is just helpful to see that. And then instead to say, oh, can I just stay with this desire, not check the phone, recognize that I'm probably having a lot of desire now. But then, as best you can, just to stay with it and then notice, oh yeah, there can be some ease and some contentment that can arise just by being with the desire and it not being needing to be different. We're learning something here, that this novelty and connection that we thought would arise by checking our phone, when we don't do it, we can see, oh yeah, there's a way in which recognizing the desire and just allowing the experience to be there and not wanting it to be different, then a sense of contentment can arise. A sense of sufficiency can arise. Or let's say that there's this way that ill will has arisen. And there's this way that maybe ill will and aversion sometimes is associated with heat. Sometimes there can be like heat in the face or just heat in the body. And there's this way that it kind of can distort our perception. And then when we're angry, it's easy to believe this storyline of, you know, why we're angry. This person, they shouldn't do that. Those people over there, don't they know? They shouldn't do that. Maybe we're angry at ourselves. I don't know why I keep on doing this. It's not helpful. But is there a way that we can remember that our perceptions might be distorted, and even a drop of kindness, a kindness towards recognizing, oh yeah, ill will and aversion is here, and I don't have to have aversion to the aversion. I don't have to have ill will to the ill will. And instead to just meet it. And then we can notice that if we can meet it as best we can and we're no longer feeding it with more ill will, it starts to calm down. This is the nature of hindrances when we meet them. Not only do they arise, but they also pass away. And then not only is it diminishing, but we're learning something too. We're learning that we don't have to act out all of our aversion or ill will. And then it reveals this way in which the mind does kind of like tend to contract. Or sometimes if we're annoyed at somebody else, this experience of contracting and othering, like making kind of, there's a way in which we like just turn other people into more like objects. They're just that person that does that thing. They're not a fullness of their humanity isn't available there. So when we can meet the ill will or aversion as best we can with some care, just meet it how it is, we'll notice that it starts to abate because we're no longer fueling it. And we'll also learn about, our way in which we treat others, or what's with anger that we start to kind of like get disconnected from others and start to think, I'm angry at this person, instead of recognizing the way in which we are connected and not so different. Other people are humans too. And this way, we can have this, maybe some care can show up, and maybe a wider and more spacious frame can arise. Or maybe there's dullness, drowsiness, or maybe restlessness, and these energy imbalances. And part of the art of practice, part of the art of meditation is experimenting with different ways, with our amount of effort that we're doing, the amount of energy that we're applying. And when we recognize, there's really not a lot of energy here, maybe there's a way we can play with, can that be okay? And can we just get curious and play with this whole notion of what does it feel like to almost fall asleep? And then chances are you will fall asleep. And then chances are you'll have this kind of, wake, this jerk thing that the body does when that we wake up. This can be fantastic. This can be amazing to learn that, we have these ideas that mindfulness can't follow us into this falling asleep, but it can. It can be really amazing to like notice how the hypnagogic, how the images get kind of wavy and the mind starts getting dreamy. So we start to learn that we have these ideas like, I can only be mindful here. I can't be mindful there. Instead, we start to learn, I can bring this to all parts of my practice. And this way that also it exposes, or if we are noticing the energy imbalances, it probably is showing us when there's some ways in which we can train wise effort, in which we can train how much energy we're putting in towards our meditation. Also, during one retreat, there was I had this idea, I don't remember where I got this idea, that I wanted to track the hindrances. I thought it would be helpful. So I very dutifully, as a person who loves graphs and tables and, Excel spreadsheets, I love this kind of stuff. So I had made this chart, and I was very discreetly put in a little notebook that I put, under my zabuton, right? On retreats, you're not supposed to be doing journaling, but you can take notes. So the end of a meditation, sitting meditation, the bell would ring. Most everybody leaves. And I was sitting near the back, and I'd wait till the people behind me had left so they wouldn't see. And then I'd discreetly pull my little notebook out, and I had this little chart, and I'd write down, the time, and then each hindrance on a scale of 1 to 5. How was it, This turned out to be so helpful. I couldn't believe it. Because it helped me to recognize, 2 sets earlier in the day, I had tremendous restlessness, but actually it was, only a 1 this time. And this time, this is a 4. And it just started to recognize, these things are changing. And sometimes they're there and sometimes they're not there. And then it became also interesting during my meditation to to be meditating to say, oh yeah, okay, here's desire. It's a three. But, even just to say it's a three is a way to shift your relationship. It's instead of like, oh, I got to get rid of this thing. This is a problem. Just to get curious about it and to like notice what is the experience of it. And so there's this way that these obstacles, quote unquote, these hindrances, we often are thinking that they have to go away or have to be different. But can we just notice them? And can we shift our relationship with them? And these two movements of noticing and shifting our relationship, we can learn so much about ourselves. We can learn a lot about the nature of meditation, that sometimes maybe just applying antidotes, if you know antidotes, or just holding the space like, yeah, okay, this is what not having a lot of energy feels like, and just feel it and just be with it and notice that things shift, and if we don't like get tangled up with them, that we can just learn and maybe find the greater contentment there. And then I'll talk a little bit just about this fifth hindrance, doubt, because I used to like sometimes have this feeling like, oh, I'm not sure what's happening. Like it'd be a little bit of confusion. And I, this idea, you're supposed to be mindful of everything. And I had this sense of, I'm just a little confused about what is this, or getting tangled up. Is this restlessness or is this aversion? They both have this, up energy sometimes. Until I was, it might have been a teacher that told me this. I can't remember, but I recognized if I said to myself, I'm confused, then I wasn't confused, because I knew that I was confused, and that's not confusion. And that was really helpful. Like, oh, no, that's a moment of clarity right there. I'm not confused. I know that I'm confused. That's not confusion. So there's this way in which just meeting what was happening just kind of like helped me to learn like, okay, yep, sometimes confusion happens. And it's okay. And it's okay. Because there's a way in which so many of us have this feeling like, well, we need to know everything. We need to know the way forward. We need to know what's happening. We need to understand everything. And then this trying to figure things out and know turns out to be a trap. Then we just get disconnected from our experience and just lost in the mind trying to figure things out. But instead, if we can just be with our experience and learn from what's happening, then what we often perceive as in the way actually is the way. So maybe that was, I don't know, sometimes I feel like I'm trying too hard with these. Like, it seemed like a good idea when I was earlier today thinking about this talk, when I have an idea and I stretch it out. But it's something that I like about this, though, is that it's a way in which we often disconnect from our practice or disconnect from being present for our lives sometimes, because there's a way we can kind of feel like, ah, if only this thing weren't here. Whether this is in meditation or our life. And then there's a way that we kind of maybe are getting a little more passive with our life, or we're not engaging, or we're like just feeling overwhelmed or and collapsing. Maybe that's the word. We're kind of just collapsing with things because we feel like we have to, that other person has to be different, or we have to be different. But this practice is not asking us to be anybody than who we are. And it's trying to show us that we can meet everything. We can meet everything. And I would say especially those things we don't want to is absolutely the way forward. And that is a practice, right? It's a habit often of just bouncing off of the things we don't want and avoiding them. But absolutely the way forward, as best we can, in any way, any setting, whether it's in meditation or in daily life, can we meet those things exactly that we don't want to meet? With presence. Maybe that's all that's needed. Maybe that's all that's available, just to recognize and say, yep, a lot of aversion is here right now. There's a way just recognizing helps to kind of provide enough space that maybe we don't get carried away with it. So I'll stop there and open it up for some comments and questions. Thank you.
What you talked about reminded me of 12-step groups, because I have some experience with that path, and it's like your addiction is your practice.
Nice, nice, very much so. Perfect. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks for the talk. When I was hearing it,
is that turned on? Yeah,
yeah, testing.
Can you put that a little bit this way? There we go. Thank you.
Cool. yeah, so when I was hearing the talk, I was making the connection between the hindrances and conditioned thinking. And I don't know if there's a natural connection, but it's giving me like kind of an idea of like how to be more curious. Like if a hindrance comes up, for example, like, you know, I'm averse to something, I can be curious about where does that come from in my conditioned thinking. So I don't know if the sutta say anything about that, or these are just two very different concepts. But that's what the talk, made me, one of the things it made me think of.
Yeah, thank you. Can you say a little bit more what you mean about conditioned thinking?
Yeah, or maybe that's not the right phrase, but the idea that like from early on, we have certain patterns, thoughts or behaviors that we didn't necessarily control. So they're just kind of applied. And it made me think about when we have hindrances, we can be averse to something or we can have desires for things. And those may come from these conditioned patterns. And so I thought it might be interesting as a meditation practice to be curious about, you know, not just noticing, oh, there's a hindrance here, but where might this come from?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. Well, the problem, I can appreciate it. It's fantastic to recognize things don't just magically appear necessarily, right? They're due to a process. But then we could spend our whole meditation period going like, oh yeah, I'm averse to this because there's that time I fell off my bike when I was 8. And then there's that time that my uncle said this. And then we could just spend all our time kind of like going down memory lane or trying to figure it out. But I think what you're pointing to, though, is really important, this recognition, like, oh, yeah, we didn't, it's like there's a reason why it arose, or we didn't make it happen. Let's maybe say that. It's not like you chose to have that particular hindrance arise at that time or something like that. It's arising for a reason, and it's going to pass away again. Whether we know what that reason is or not, there is one. Maybe that's helpful. If we're trying to figure it all out, we could spend our whole meditation period trying to figure it out.
Yeah, then that's kind of the balance. It's easy to go overboard.
Yes, we can get lost to that, and then lots of stories and stuff. Anybody else have a comment or...
I was wondering if there's a connection between the hindrances or what the overlap or intersection is and emotions.
Do you want to say, do you have a sense?
No, I feel confused.
That's so great. I love that. So that, it's fascinating how in the kind of like the Buddhist literature, there isn't exactly emotions, right? They're not talked about in the way that we talk about them in the contemporary West. That's, you know, after Freud and all this kind of stuff, we have this different idea of emotions than the Buddha did. But what's similar is this idea of mind states that can hinder or get in the way. So in that way, they're the same. Like sometimes if we, I mean, there can be a way in which sadness is a perfectly legitimate, healthy response to loss or something like this. And so that it's not a hindrance, it's just a healthy expression. But there can also be a way in which we collapse into sadness as opposed to feeling anger, for example, or something. Or I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know all the reasons why. But there could be a way in which sadness, our collapsing into sadness, is a way for us to disconnect from our experience. And maybe that hinders, quote-unquote, maybe the fullness of our life. So I do not want to say that emotions are always in the way, because they're not. And I would say that part of what this practice enables us, when I'm pointing to meeting, I was using the word hindrances, is this practice points to our increasing our capacity to be with the whole range of emotions, the whole range of a rich human life. So, but there are times in which some emotions can be a hindrance, but I would say our practice allows us to even meet that, even when sadness is, we're collapsing into sadness, just for example, as a way to not be with anger. We can meet that too. Is that helpful, Karen?
Yes, thank you.
Mostly, I just want to say thank you for sharing that little bit about your little secret.
Oh, that notebook I had about hindrances.
Because I think it's very beautiful when teachers share with us how that we ourselves find our little ways to work with the Dharma and to make it come alive for us. And I love charts too, and so I so get it. I never thought to do that. It could happen now, but I wanted to thank you for that. I found it very beautiful.
Great, thank you, thank you.
Hi, thank you for the talk. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on working with something like trauma or clinical depression, and how that gets met in a way that, you know, isn't damaging or flooding for the person practicing in the way that turns towards.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, for mentioning this. Yeah, so there is sometimes in which maybe mindfulness practice, sitting with in a meditation posture with eyes closed, is not the best thing, because sometimes with clinical depression or trauma, like relating to other people is really what's helpful, instead of just being alone and, you know, meeting things. And then, because we can get into overwhelm, this happens all the time. I mean, with whether you have trauma or clinical depression or not, there's a way we can meet things in meditation. And if we don't have enough, what we could say, resources, you know, a feeling of stability, a feeling of safety, a feeling of well-being, enough well-being, then we can get into overwhelm. So your question is about mindfulness or meeting, I'm saying, like what the hindrance is. It's a little bit different than I would say is trauma and clinical depression. I would definitely, mindfulness can be a support, but it needs some care, I would say, and some recognition that there's a way that work, when we, let's say this, when people go on retreats or they do a lot of meditating, then there's this way in which if we're not witnessed by others, then we can have ideas in our mind, and then we can just grow and grow and grow, and then we can kind of have these ideas catastrophizing or these ideas about ourselves that aren't very healthy or supportive. So meditation can be helpful. We can meet whatever's arising, but that's particularly if we are resourced and if we're in the midst of processing a lot of trauma or clinical depression. It's better if that's done with people and are talking and something like this, as opposed to in a long retreat or something like that. Is this helpful? I think my thoughts were a little convoluted
thank
there.
Thank you. It reminds me a little bit of Peter Levine's work and the titration.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yep, I could have just said that word and that would have been so much easier. Thank you.
I was sitting here thinking, as you were talking, of my own experience of being hungry at the moment and desire to eat. So I was thinking, well, all these aversions seem like somehow they're related to being afraid of dying.
Oh.
And I always wondered if, like, there's something about that, like being less afraid of dying is kind of what you're talking about.
Being less afraid of dying.
Yeah, like, or if any of these things aren't met, that will be okay.
Oh. So say that again. So if the hindrances are met.
Are not met. That will be okay. Like, it's like you're creating space, and maybe the space felt to me like, oh, maybe it's like reassurance, like just that simple. I don't know.
I like this idea, reassurance that things are okay. I'm okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
I remember Gil Fronstahl saying this sometime. This is like just everything. It's okay. It's okay. But it turns out to be very helpful.
Thanks.
Okay, we're at the end of our time here. So thank you all. Thank you all. I wish you a wonderful rest of the evening and safe travels home. Thank you.